Senate Bill 528 relating to the spousal defense and sexual assault. Under current Alaska law, it is an affirmative defense that at the time of the offense, the victim was the spouse of the defendant, unless the spouses were living apart or physical injury was caused to the victim. Section 1 of the bill states that in cases of first and second degree sexual assault, it is not a defense that the victim is the spouse of the defendant. Section 2 intends to exempt cases where minors are legally married from prosecution under the sexual assault of a minor statute as long as there is consent. We also considered this issue last year in conjunction with Senate Bill 74. And we have persons waiting to be heard. Patty Costello.
My name is Patty Costello. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm director of the University of Alaska Women's Center and on the board of Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance in Fairbanks. I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 528. The marital exemption to the violent crime of rape is invariably traced back to the 17th century, when Matthew Hale, Chief Justice in England, announced that the husband cannot be guilty of a rape committed by himself upon his lawful wife, for by their mutual consent and contract, the wife hath given up herself in this kind unto her husband, which she cannot contract. This ruling was based upon the notion that women were the property of their husbands and that procreation was the sole purpose of matrimony. Since most of us have had sexual intercourse, and because our magazines, movies, and now television have given so much time and attention to sexuality, it is impossible for us not to relate personally to this discussion of marital rape. I kindly request that those considering the bill refrain from imagining in their minds a gallant Rhett Butler sweeping a petulant Scarlett O'Hara off her feet and up the stairs, followed in keeping with 1950s sense of proprieties, a fade out to the next morning of a sun-filled room and a smiling Scarlett. I emphatically assure you that that is not the situation out of which a marital rape charge could ever arise. Until fairly recently, our laws reflected the opinion of many lawmakers that rape was a charge easily made and difficult to defend against. However, as the recently highly publicized New Bedford rape trial reaffirmed, the woman victim was very much on trial as well. Her past sexual history and behavior, her motivation, and even what she was wearing and where she was at the time of the crime are given thorough public scrutiny. Through the increasing number of studies being done, we are learning that rape is a crime of violence. It rises out of a desire for conquest and domination, greatly exacerbated by the media images that tell us sexual prowess is part of the definition of masculinity. As in the case of domestic violence, sexual violence in the context of marriage exists on a continuum. The continuum extends from a nonviolent marriage, where sex is the result of mutual desire and consent, all the way to the opposite extreme of the rape murder of a spouse. As long as a wife rape is condoned by our legal system, many men will continue to feel that their wife has no right to refuse sex, and many women will continue to feel that they have no right to control their own bodies. By 1980, New Jersey, Oregon, and Nebraska completely abolished the marital rape exemption. It has been variously considered and debated in many other states since that time. State-by-state variance is so extreme that in West Virginia, a man may not be charged with first-degree sexual assault if the woman has ever been a voluntary social companion of the man, even though they have never had mutually consensual sexual relations. In arguing for Senate Bill 528 and against marital exemption, I first cite the moral and philosophical implications of the law as it presently exists. To allow marital exemption endorses the antiquated principle that women are property. Those who would argue that the charge will be made lightly and that the circumstances will be ambiguous should take some time to familiarize themselves with the recent work of Irene Fries, Nicholas Groth, Del Martin, and Diane Russell. The case study descriptions make sobering and chilling reading. The marital exemption has been shown to be in violation of the constitutional right to equal protection, both in the sense of married versus unmarried women and in the sense of wives versus husbands. Further, why in this one instance are we saying the identity and relationship of the perpetrator to the victim is relevant to our judgment of the crime? Isn't murder always murder? Is murder less serious if you murder your wife or your child? distortion of justice to rule that rape outside of marriage is a violent, heinous crime, while within the bounds of matrimony it is allowable. Nor does the evidence support the charge that rape is less traumatic to a woman when it is done by a man with whom there have been previous mutual consent. The violation of personal trust can be deeply disturbing, and we know from case studies that marital rape frequently occurs in conjunction with life-threatening violence. To tolerate wife rape in law is to minimize the seriousness of rape in other contexts. When we codify bigotry and racial prejudice, we tacitly perpetuate that prejudice. So too with violence. Violence condoned, made glamorous in our media and entertainment, violence used as a subject for humor, violence excused by its context, promotes and perpetuates violence. To quote Diane Russell from her book, Rape in Marriage, to continue to see rape in marriage as husband's privilege is not only an insult, but a danger to all women. We must strive to stop wife rape, including working to eliminate the conditions that have given rise to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Fisher has a question.
That's a marvelous statement. I'd very much like to have it in writing. I see you've made some changes.
They haven't typed it.
If you would give it to us, we'll clean type it and put a heading on it and make sure your name is on there and make sure that they have it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, especially for coming to Fairbanks. Carla,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carla Tinkone. I'm the statewide coordinator of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, a nonprofit corporation representing 20 programs statewide. Rather than read to you the network's position paper, which I have already submitted, as well as the letter submitted to members of the committee by Paula Haley, executive director of the STAR program in Anchorage, and try to follow Patty's excellent testimony, I'll just make myself available for questions if any members of the committee have questions.
Thank you. As noted, we did hear testimony on this in 1983, so it's not a new proposition to us. Other questions? No, why don't you stand by?
Thank you.
Are there other persons who wish to be heard on this matter? Gail?
Mr. Chairman, just briefly a technical matter. For the record, I'm Gail Goretzky from the Department of Law. I would suggest that the committee consider on line 17 of the bill the insertion of the language, or attempted to engage, so that line would read, unless the defendant engaged or attempted to engage in sexual penetration. As it's drafted right now, it would actually require that the penetration or contact have been accomplished in order for the affirmative defense not to apply.
What is the phrase sexual contact?
Both penetration, Mr. Chairman, and sexual contact are defined in the statutes in AS 11, 81, 900B, 52, and 54, and they talk about contact is the intentional touching by the defendant of the victim's genitals, anus, or female breast, or the defendant causing the victim to touch the victim or the defendant's anus, genitals, or female breast. So it's a term of art, if you will, that's defined in the statute.
I'm just wondering why in section 2 we sort of phrase it as we do in the prosecution under blah blah blah. It is an affirmative defense that at the time of the alleged offense the victim was the legal spouse of the defendant unless the defendant engaged it. I mean, in effect, we're saying it is not a defense the victim was at any time legal spouse of the defendant. But why can't we just rewrite the whole section and make it read the same as section 1?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Senator, I haven't drafted this, but when I looked at it and studied it, I thought I understood the reason why. The forcible rape is sexual assault in the first degree and forcible sexual contact the second degree, and that's what comes under section 1, 410 and 420. The provisions referred to in 434 through 440 are child sexual abuse of various degrees and, if I'm not mistaken, incest. What that means is that in some states, for example, a fairly young girl can be married to a man who is older than her. And it may be that due to the age of the parties, that behavior, that is, consensual sexual penetration or contact between those parties would be an offense under our statutes, depending if the girl was 15 or 16. But if they are legally married, then he's not guilty of child abuse in the X degree, unless if it's forcible rape, then that affirmative defense is not
allowed. Thank you.
Are there other witnesses or questions on this bill? Senator Fisher?
Yes, Jim. I would like to move that the committee adopt a substitute of the amended language on line 17 and pass the bill, pass the committee substitute out with individual recommendations.
Objection. Not that. You done? We'll move on now to Senate Bill 384 relating to food banks. Similar bill was passed by the 12th legislature, the governor hadn't vetoed it because the standard of negligence was considered not sufficient to offer public protection for donors. Senate Bill 384, as drafted, does what in this respect?
There's two different standards, gross negligence for donors and simple negligence for the food banks. And the definitions include slaughterhouse under donor and on the exclusion of section B under donor states that it would be a person's primary activity as a manufacturing factor processor.
There are significant differences between this bill and the bill passed by the 11th legislature. House Bill 496.
It's a similar House bill.
All right. Specifically excludes commercial manufacturers, processors, and bottlers. The previous legislation did not. Here's that. Donor excludes. Yeah, that's on page 2, lines 21 to 23. Where House Bill 496 describes in details the conditions the food bank or donor must meet to be released from liability, 1980 legislation only said that adulteration could not result from intentional or grossly negligent conduct by the donor. The vetoed bill dealt only with donors. This bill also provides a limited immunity for food banks. It appears this bill accommodates this could answer government concerns. We're told the DEC does not object to the bill, gives it a fiscal zero fiscal note, and actually feels the note can even go farther than it does without endangering the health or safety of Alaskans.
Do we have a statement for that?
The gentleman was here. We have a zero fiscal note.
Wait, why did he leave?
Because I showed him the committee substitute, and he said that's exactly what we wanted to see that.
And he no longer feels he could provide more, or he does feel. And what's the difference between the 384 and CS 384?
It's the two different standards of negligence. Gross negligence for the donor and simple negligence for the food bank, and the insertion of slaughterhouse under donor and under the exclusion section that was that it's a primary activity.
Governor Hammond's concern was that the old bill would allow a manufacturer to donate food of marginal thickness and obtain a tax credit. People receiving donated food are entitled to the same protection as persons that might buy food. So that particular objection is solved.
There was something that there was someone.
Would you like me to call for the
what?
I
don't have any concern about it. This is sort of like the Beans Cafe situation.
Okay, if you're ready, you'll be looking at it somewhere in judiciary. Unless there's anything else, Mr. Chairman, I'll move the CS and move that we pass the CS out with individual recommendations.
Would you ask the DEC to send a letter on this?
Ask an
objection. Objection. Here's an objection. We'll do that. And then finally, an act relating to recovery of medical assistance expenses. Department of Health and Social Services a statutory basis to collect third-party insurance payments for medical expenditures under Medicaid and GIM. And Mr. Petit is here from HESS. Mr. Petit. Rod, do you want to talk to this program?
Sure. For the record, I'm Rod Beattie, Director of the Division of Public Assistance. The purpose of this bill is simply to simplify our efforts to get as money as the state is entitled to when we step in and take care of a person medically that's been involved in some kind of an accident or other injury. Currently, we spend a lot of time debating with insurance companies and other parties whether or not we're entitled to those funds. What this bill would do in those situations is put us out in front of that individual as far as being entitled to collect those funds up to the level that we paid out Medicaid monies to take care of their medical problems, and they would be entitled to anything beyond that. The second piece of the bill would specify that where attorney fees are involved, where it wasn't stipulated that those were above and beyond the claim received, that we would pay our fair share of those attorney fees. If we got 50% of the settlement, we would in effect pay 50% of the attorney fees out of our portion of the settlement. So it's simply to go on record and to provide a state level statute that would permit us to get out of this ongoing debate and spend more time collecting rather than arguing about whether or not we're entitled to those funds. We think that over a period of time we can see several hundred thousand dollars more in annual collections by our staff if we had this problem put behind us. It costs nothing administratively to implement this.
Questions?
Just a comment that isn't often that we get bills that actually would create more money, provide revenues rather than costs.
Okay. Is there objection to moving this bill? If not, the bill will be recorded and serving for signature. And that concludes our meeting.
Very good.